From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, is the boom in production, especially in television, leading to more dangerous work environments for stunt performers? Then why horror master John Carpenter now prefers making music to making movies.
Spent most of my life under the spell of the cinema goddess. See, that's my first love. But she is a harsh mistress. Cinema kills you.
And in the movie It, a clown does the killing, but a four-year-old girl does all that creepy singing. Coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by the Netflix film The Other Side of the Wind. Witness the last film from legendary director Orson Welles, a cinematic event 40 years in the making. The Other Side of the Wind, on Netflix and in select theaters November 2nd.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. For many of us, peak TV means too many good shows and not enough time to watch them. But is there also a darker side to the scripted content boom? Scott Johnson, a senior writer at The Hollywood Reporter, talked to several stunt performers, and they told him that the massive increase in new shows and demanding production schedules means that some producers and stunt coordinators who oversee stunts on set are cutting corners when it comes to safety. There's some terrible evidence to back that up. Last year, two stunt performers died on the job. One was a motorcycle racer doing her first ever stunt work. Here's Scott Johnson. I reached him on Skype today to talk about his reporting.
With John Bernecker's death on the set of The Walking Dead in the spring of 2017, it was the first on-set stunt-related death in the United States in 15 years. And then just a month later, or a couple months later, Joy Harris on the set of Deadpool 2 in Canada was the second death. So all of a sudden, after a significant time of what appeared to be relative safety, the stunt community was faced with the reality that there was something afoot. And these two deaths were both notable in the sense that there were experienced stunt coordinators on set in both places, and yet, something went wrong in both cases.
And it's not just the deaths. There have been a number of injuries, some where people have lost limbs, some traumatic brain injuries. So before we get into why this might be happening because of the number of productions, I've always thought that visual effects had evolved to the point where people didn't need to do physically dangerous things, that you could use computers to essentially put somebody in the most dangerous situation, even if they weren't in that dangerous situation.
And that certainly does happen. There are lots of very big budget productions that use visual effects to great effect. But there are still, with the advent of all of these new streaming television programs, there's a huge demand for real stunt people doing real things on productions from New Hampshire to Los Angeles and everywhere in between. And so what we're seeing is that the huge glut of content is leading to what many people in the stunt community say, a kind of more permissive environment where less experienced stunt coordinators and also less experienced stunt people are doing more dangerous things, and that's leading to more deaths and injuries.
We often hear stories of actors who claim, falsely, that they do their own stunts. What does that create in terms of the dynamic for stunt performers about their ability to speak out about what they're doing, to say that they actually have done the stunts? Isn't part of the problem that stunt performers feel that they don't have a lot of voice to talk about their own work and to ask about safety conditions?
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, there's sort of a catch-22 at work in that there is, many stunt people told me that there is a very real fear that if they don't display enthusiasm and an immediate willingness to do the work that's being asked of them, they might not get work in the future. They might get blacklisted. On the other hand, there is no, within the SAG union, there's no set of qualifications for stunt performers or stunt coordinators. So they, like actors, fall under the SAG union, and they don't really have to produce any tangible set of qualifications in order to get jobs. They don't have to take tests. They don't have to pass any kind of exam. They don't have to demonstrate to producers or productions that they know what they're doing, or that they can prove that they know how to do, you know, a backflip or a slide or, you know, a hit against a wall or anything like that. And so the onus is on them to sort of display their resume or beef it up as they see fit. And oftentimes that leads to problems down the road for everybody.
You say in your story that Harris's death was, quote, an eye-opener, according to Court Hessler, who's the chair of SAG-AFTRA's Stunt and Safety Committee. What is SAG-AFTRA's role in all of this?
Well, they're in a little bit of a tough spot because, as many of them told me, they have been deliberating and working on issues around safety for literally decades. And one of the problems is that it's very hard to get agreement among all the members about what should be in place. You know, should SAG be the policeman for qualification process? Should it be up to the production? Should there be some sort of independent agency that monitors this kind of thing? And they've been unable to come to any definitive answer. After Harris's death, I think a lot of them sort of took a step back and said, okay, this, you know, we really need to address this and think about this in some sort of new way that is going to help us all as a community. And so a couple of weeks ago, they passed a new measure. The board passed a new measure, which essentially it's an online registry for stunt coordinators. And so stunt coordinators who have 500 or more days of working will appear on this list. And SAG's position is that productions will view this list as sort of the de facto reference point. However, the problem is that it's not mandatory, and there's no qualification built into the registry. So essentially, productions are still free to hire whomever they want, wherever they want, and you know, they can essentially do whatever they want. And so SAG is taking these kind of piecemeal steps, little bit at a time, but they're, as they told me, they're far from having, you know, a very clear-cut answer to the issue of safety in the stunt community.
Scott Johnson is a senior writer at The Hollywood Reporter. He's the author of the article, Stunted, How Hollywood's Content Boom is Leading to More Stunt Person Injuries and Deaths. Scott, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Filmmaker John Carpenter has been scaring audiences since the 70s. Up next on The Frame, what gives him nightmares?
KPCC podcasts are supported by the Netflix film The Other Side of the Wind. Witness the last film from legendary director Orson Welles, The Other Side of the Wind. The story of a director named J.J. Jake Hannaford, who returns to Hollywood from years of semi-exile in Europe with plans to complete work on his own innovative comeback movie, also entitled The Other Side of the Wind. A cinematic event 40 years in the making. The Other Side of the Wind. On Netflix and in select theaters November 2nd.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Tonight is, of course, Halloween. And if you'd like to help me give out some candy, please swing by my house in Pasadena. In some years, we get as many as 1,000 trick-or-treaters. Seriously, it's a very expensive holiday. But my home is not the only place where people are lining up for Halloween. At the Multiplex, the movie of the same name is doing huge business. In fewer than 2 weeks in theaters, the horror reboot has grossed more than $132 million. The franchise was created by John Carpenter 40 years ago, and that horror film, much of which was shot not far from our offices at KPCC, wasn't Carpenter's only notable production. He also made The Fog, The Thing, Escape from New York, and Starman, among other films. In addition to directing movies, Carpenter also writes and performs music, and he helped pioneer the use of synthesizers in film scores. While he's best known for his film composing, including the famous score for Halloween, Carpenter is now playing live shows of original songs that aren't from any movie. He's made two albums of such music, Lost Themes and Lost Themes 2, and he's performing tonight at the Palladium in Hollywood. We visited with Carpenter at his home/studio in Hollywood, and we started by talking about his score for his 76 movie, Assault on Precinct 13.
I was in mid-Los Angeles at a studio called Sound Arts, and it was run by Dan Wyman. He was a synthesizer teacher at USC, and he owned all these synthesizers, and he had them in a studio. And then he had a setup there, microphone and so forth. All the synthesizers were the old-fashioned kind. You had to tune them before you could play them. You had to get it, whether it's a sawtooth or what kind of a wave it was, and the tuning. And it was unbelievable. So I was there for one day, and that's when I recorded this.
Did you have the finished picture? Did you were you scoring to a finished film? Did you know what the cues were going to be?
I did not have a finished picture there because we didn't have the technology nor the money to score to picture. So I just scored it and cut it into the picture later.
I want to play another piece of music. This is probably one of the pieces of music you're best known for.
Okay. Got it.
So I got to ask you, do you not like listening to your own music?
I got it. Thank you.
So when you test a movie, and I don't know if you had a chance to do this with Halloween, with and without music, or show it to friends and family with and without music, what do you notice music does to a story in terms of how the audience is receiving that story?
Well, music can and often heightens the experience of watching a movie, makes it bigger than it really is, makes it stronger, more visceral. And sometimes the lack of music can be very powerful, but it's the combination of those two things, I think, that make a movie very, very memorable.
When you're thinking about writing music for a picture, do you start thinking about melodies? Do you start thinking about instrumentation? A lot of your scores early on were pretty bare. You didn't, it's not like you had a 90-piece orchestra. Where does the idea for the music start to appear in your own creative mind?
Well, now you use the word write the music. I don't write music. This is all improvised music. So it just comes out. And that is because I spent my early life, my childhood, growing up around music and around classical music. My father was a music teacher, and he had a PhD from Eastman School of Music. He was a virtuoso on the violin. So that's all he did, was play classical music, and I absorbed it all. And somewhere inside the brain, it's cooking around, and along with some movie music too that I remember. And so I just improvise all this stuff. It's not written. It's not written anywhere. I don't know what I'm going to do before I do it. Everything I've done, I can use this one word, is instinct. That's all it comes from.
I know you're not a fan of listening to your own music, but we'll just listen to a little bit of something else here.
Got it. I love that piece of music. I really do.
So what do you mean by that? Why do you love it? That's Angel's Asylum. Why do you like that more maybe than some other thing you've written?
It just creates a mood in me. It makes me feel good to hear it. It reminds me of, I don't know, maybe horror movie music I've seen, or I'm not really sure. My son and I recorded it, so maybe that's part of it too.
What has that creative process been like to collaborate with your son on writing and performing music?
Joyous. It's absolutely joyous. I spent most of my life under the spell of the cinema goddess. See, that's my first love. Cinema is my first love. But she is a harsh mistress. Cinema kills you. And I've done a lot of movies, and at some point along the way, I said, I can't do this anymore. It's too much stress. It's too much anxiety. It's killing me. So along comes making music, which is an absolute joy. Absolutely fabulous. I'm working with my family. My son and godson are working with me on this music, and I couldn't be happier. It's astonishingly great.
We're talking with filmmaker and musician John Carpenter. Screenwriters will often say that if they are given a choice between adapting a piece of material and writing something original, they will always defer to the adapted because the story's in place and they know what their assignment is. It's figuring out the math of it. Whereas writing an original screenplay, you have to have some sort of muse and come up with an original idea. Is there an equal argument about music if you're writing music to a score, to a scene in a film, versus just writing music that is for your own pleasure? And is it almost the opposite of what I've described for screenwriters?
Well, it's just different. Making music for a movie, you're working with an image that's right in front of you. You're watching it go by. So that helps you. That directs the length, the tempo, exactly what's happening. Writing, I could see why writers talk about they love to adapt things because it's less work, it's less hard. But it's all the same process in the end. You're sitting there with a keyboard, whether you have an image in front of you or not, and you're laying down some music. It's all the same.
In terms of audience, when you think about the way that the audience, the live audience, receives music as opposed to watching an audience watch one of your films, is it a different experience? Because one, you're kind of performing on stage, and the other, you might be in the wings or the back of the house watching the audience react to it. Is that a different experience to watch how an audience reacts to your own material?
It's more immediate when you're standing up on the stage. Being a movie director is... it's like a remote control artist. You're doing a lot of things, but you're not doing them personally. You're directing a scene and there are actors in front of you and you're telling them what you want out of a scene and you're helping them get there. When you're watching an audience react to a movie and you're standing in the back of a theater, it's a remote control experience. You're not directly involved. You're not directly out there. But you are if you're performing music. I'm standing up front.
You said that performing live music at first terrified you. What terrifies you as an audience member?
Oh, in a movie.
Correct.
Movies don't really scare me. Real life scares me. The behavior of human beings scare me. Oh, I'll give you an example. Assad in Syria, his behavior towards chemically gassing children, that scares me. How is a human being capable of that? What kind of evil walks the earth in reality? Not in the movies. Movies is fake. Vampires and werewolves don't exist. Assad does. He's real. That's scary.
Does that numb us as an audience to what is scary and what is considered beyond comprehension in evil?
Well, we don't want to experience that. So the safe way to do it is you take your girlfriend or your wife to a movie and we sit there and we watch a bunch of monsters running around and we scream in safety and we work out all our fears in a nice, pleasant environment. And we can have popcorn and Coca-Colas or Pepsi, whatever we want to drink, and have a good time. And that it's just like when you eat a hamburger. You don't want to know how that hamburger is really made. We don't want to know about that. That it's, if you knew, you would never eat another hamburger.
So what you're suggesting is the scarier the world is, the longer we're going to have scary movies.
You know it, always. Because we're all afraid. We're all born afraid. We're all afraid of the same things. We're afraid of our own death, death of loved ones. You can name everything you're afraid of. So am I. So horror movies will be with us always. And what they will do is, every generation will come along and renew them and make them for a new generation and make them in a new direction. That's what it should be.
John Carpenter, thanks for letting us come visit.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
The latest Halloween movie, which was directed by David Gordon Green, is in theaters now. Coming up, the score for the movie It features a 4-year-old girl whose mom has never seen the movie. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Quick reminder, you can find our podcast wherever you like to listen, and that includes iTunes, Spotify, and the NPR One app. In recent episodes, we found out how the writers and producers of The Good Place actually get tutorials from philosophy professors, and that allows them to weave all those moral dilemmas and ethics lessons into the comedy on a weekly basis. And now, in keeping with the Halloween theme, we've pulled an eerie one from The Frame Crypt.
I'm not supposed to take stuff from strangers.
Oh, well, I'm Pennywise the Dancing Clown. Now we aren't strangers, are we?
A little more than a year ago, the movie It, based on the 1986 Stephen King novel featuring a terrifying clown, broke the record for the biggest opening weekend ever for a horror movie when it took in $123 million. The movie went on to become the highest-grossing R-rated horror film of all time, grossing more than $700 million worldwide. The very first thing you hear when the movie opens is the voice of a little girl singing a nursery rhyme. The Frame contributor Tim Grieving brings us the story of why this seemingly innocent sound is so bone-chilling.
That's the voice of Elodie Barker. She's 4 years old. What is such a sweet little girl doing setting the mood for a very grisly, grown-up, R-rated horror movie about a child-murdering clown? And why is her sweet little voice so creepy?
She sings all the time. She has done since she was tiny. She's a sweet, lovely voice and just makes up songs about everything.
That's Elodie's mom, Harriet Frazier. She's a former doctor, and now she sings with the Los Angeles Master Chorale. A few months ago, she got an email from someone who books vocals for recordings, who was looking for 5- and 6-year-old singers.
Actually, I didn't know it was for this film at the time. And I thought, well, she acts like a 5-year-old, so I did a little recording of her singing Row, Row, Row Your Boat and sent it along. And then the email came and he said, this is what it's for. We need both parents to sign off on it. It's a kind of strange thing to have little children in.
The idea of using the old English nursery rhyme, Oranges and Lemons, came from director Andy Muschietti and was executed by composer Benjamin Wallfisch.
His approach, I think, was to try and find a sound for Pennywise that is somehow the sound of him thinking, the sound of him contemplating the idea of attack, or actually attacking. And what was fascinating about using something as seemingly innocent and innocuous as a children's play song is that incredible dichotomy between what's on the surface and what is under the surface.
Wallfisch gathered an untrained chorus of little girls and boys at Capitol Records for a decidedly uncreepy day of singing. Harriet Frazier says Elodie had a ball.
She doesn't know, obviously, what it was for. She called it her rehearsal, and she said, I'm going to my rehearsal. I mean, she's just full of joy when she's singing.
Wallfisch had the boys and girls sing the song in a dozen different ways.
We just asked them to characterize, so we had them sing it as if they were yawning and very tired, or screaming as if they're really angry, or whispering it like it's a secret to their neighbor.
Oranges and Lemons usually plays when Pennywise is baiting his next victim, and Wallfisch manipulated the vocals and added disturbing orchestration. When I talked to Harriet Frazier, she hadn't heard the score yet, so I played her a little sample. You should see her face.
Sending shivers up my spine.
The nursery rhyme was only a small part of the It score. Wallfisch wrote 2 hours of orchestral and electronic music, including themes for the friendship and puppy love that blossoms between the kid heroes, and a shape-shifting melody for the shape-shifting monster.
There's that sense of an omnipresent DNA, where even though you have distinct character themes and distinct narrative themes, they're all linked by this sensual, malevolent tune. So, the Oranges and Lemons melody, which, you know, it's very simple. The middle gesture, this, turned itself into the first gesture you hear in the composed score, which is this dairy theme. That sort of rising. And weirdly, too, in the Pennywise theme, this, that rising You know, it's somehow they're all part of this weird rising of three notes idea, which all stems back to that Oranges and Lemons, that strange song. So,
but I still want to know, how can the sound of an adorable little girl singing a nursery rhyme be the cutest thing in the world and the creepiest? Harriet Fraser offers a theory.
This pure sound coming out of a small human being is so touching and intimate, and it can be then manipulated into something amazingly joyous or manipulated with visuals into anything you want it to be.
She said she didn't have any reluctance letting little Elodie contribute her voice to this terrifying scream fest.
Although I will never see the film.
You won't see it?
No.
For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
And if you want to enjoy more scary sounds tonight, KPCC is airing Spooked, 4 hours of true life stories of the supernatural told by the people who witnessed them. It's collected by the producers of Snap Judgment. Here's a little preview.
Immediately walking in this place, the first thing that I noticed was the sound. It almost sounded like a congregation of whispers. I don't know what drew my attention to it, but I turned to face the interior wall and just saw that the wall was pockmarked with bullet holes. This had to have been a kill room. Like, they had to have lined people up in here and just executed them. It seemed like there was a malign presence there that was trying to get somebody killed.
Spook starts tonight at 8, which means The Frame's 9 p.m. airing is preempted. We'll be back here tomorrow. And that's our show for today. I'm John Horn. Have a safe Halloween.